I wanted to move on to that, but here you mentioned something which I think maybe we should go into a little bit more deeper. You mentioned Hungary. I don't want to abandon the West
yet,
but there's some things that I want to get your opinion on. So, yes, we see there's a reorientation. There's a learning process that has occurred for many countries, Russia, Iran, China, even India to a certain extent. We see that they are also understanding that this is not the same. And this issue of Eurasian integration is happening. As we say, inshallah, it will be a good thing soon for all of us. But I want to stay a little bit still because you mentioned Hungary. And we see, for example, the Baltic states. We see Finland. We see these countries that are on the border. And it seems to me that they don't really realize that they are throwing themselves into a situation where there's going to be a very hard border, maybe even something similar to the Iron Curtain, as was during the Soviet Union. And they're the ones that are going to suffer. It's not Russia that's going to suffer. I mean, you can't really compare a small country. Again, I'm using the Baltic states as an example, who are basically dependent on so many ways on their relationship with Russia. You have very large Russian-speaking populations there. You have history, very long history with the neighboring countries, Poland, you know, Slovakia, Moldavia, all those countries there. What would be your message to those decision makers, those elites, those people in those border areas? We even saw Finland and Sweden talking about joining NATO, although Finland has now stepped back a little bit today or yesterday.
No.
They said if Sweden doesn't join, we won't join either. So what would be your message to those countries? Is this really, what would you say to them?
You know, as to Finland and Sweden, we had special relationship with Finland since the end of the Second World War.
Exactly. It was a neutral country during the Cold War.
So-called line, Paasikivi Kekkonen.
Yes.
And this policy of Finland neutrality, friendly relations with the former Soviet Union and then with the Russian Federation, created very calm atmosphere alongside a Russian-Finnish border.
Mr. Messer, excuse me, because some of our audience might not know. There's a very close, the border between Finland and Russia, St. Petersburg is right there, Helsinki is very close, it's very close to each other. This is not some distant...
And we highly appreciated the policy of bipartiality, neutrality of Finland, as well as of Sweden, though in military terms they from time to time cooperated with NATO forces. And unfortunately they decided to join NATO, but we don't pose any threat neither to Finland nor to Sweden, but also to any other country.
Right.
Because, you know, one should be idiot to think that Russia is ready to invade any NATO country. Why?
Right.
Why? As to the three Baltic countries, you know, there are different pages in our bilateral history. Of course, they have their interpretation, we have our interpretation. But as you mentioned, three countries, in three of them we have Russian population. And in Latvia and Estonia, they are deprived from their human rights.
Which is...
citizens.
Excuse me, Mr. Master, because you mentioned this about the Ukraine. So in the Ukraine, we have a major, significant population that is Russian, Russian-speaking.
Yes.
It was in the constitution that their cultural and language rights be protected.
Yes.
And after this coup d'etat, and they changed the constitution, and we see similar things happening in the
They tried to ban Russian language in Latvia, in Estonia, in the Ukraine. And our question was to the British, if Ireland would ban English language, if Belgium would, ban French language, and they will say, we will speak only Flemish.
Exactly.
What would be their reaction? Of course, they would become very furious. What does it mean? It means, hypocrisy, which is so typical and not only for Americans. Double standards and hypocrisy. When we ask them a question, what happened in the Ukraine in 2014? It was a democratic transition of the government of power or not? They keep silence.
It seems that with every passing day, we are getting closer to Zbigniew Brzezinski and America's nightmare of the strategic alignment of Russia, Iran, and China, due in part to America's own irrational and short-sighted policies and strategies. Thank you for joining us on this episode. Until the next time on Insight.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Agnes Callamard, the head of Amnesty International, who investigated Jamal Khashoggi's murder in her previous role as United Nations Special Rapporteur on extrajudicial killings, said it was laughable that Saudi Prince Mohammed bin Salman could benefit from head of state immunity after the United States itself had concluded publicly that he most likely approved the operation to murder Jamal Khashoggi. We have prepared for you an article written by Stephanie Kirschgassner. The piece is titled, Judge Puts Biden on the Spot Over Immunity for Saudi Crown Prince. U.S. judge has asked the Biden administration to weigh in on whether Mohammed bin Salman, the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia, should be granted sovereign immunity in a civil case brought against him in the United States by Hatice Cengiz, the fiancé of dissident murdered journalist Jamal Khashoggi, the journalist who was killed by Saudi agents in 2018. John Bates, a district court judge, gave the U.S. government until 1st of August to declare its interest in the civil case, or give the court notice that it has no views on the matter. The Biden administration's decision could have a profound effect on the civil case and comes as Joe Biden is facing criticism for abandoning a campaign promise to turn Saudi Arabia into a pariah state. The U.S. president is due to meet the heir apparent to the Saudi throne later this month when he makes his first trip to Riyadh since entering the White House. The civil complaint against Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, which was filed by Hatice Cengiz in the Federal District Court of Washington, D.C. in October of 2020, charges that he and other Saudi officials acted in a conspiracy and with premeditation when Saudi agents kidnapped, bound, drugged, tortured, and killed Jamal Khashoggi inside the Saudi consulate building in Istanbul, Turkey, in 2018. Khashoggi, a former Saudi insider who had fled the kingdom and was resident in Virginia, United States, was a vocal critic of the young crown prince and was actively seeking to counter Saudi online propaganda at the time when he was murdered. After years of inaction against Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman by Donald Trump, who was president when Khashoggi was killed, the Biden administration moved to release an unclassified U.S. intelligence report in 2021, shortly after Biden entered the White House, that concluded the Saudi Crown Prince was likely to have ordered the murder of Khashoggi. At the time the report was released, the Saudi Foreign Ministry said the kingdom's government categorically rejects what is stated in the report provided to Congress. While Saudi Arabia said it held a trial against the hit squad responsible for the grisly murder, the proceeding was widely condemned as a sham, and some of the most senior members of the team have been cited in a state security compound in Riyadh. Other possible avenues of justice have been stymied for political reasons. A Turkish prosecutor in March ended a long-running trial in absentia, again against Jamal Khashoggi's murderers, in a move that was seen as part of the Turkish president Recep Tayyip Erdogan's attempts to improve relations with the Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman. The Saudi Crown Prince has taken responsibility for the murder on behalf of the Saudi government, but has denied any personal involvement in planning the assassination. For supporters of Hatice Cengiz, who has been an outspoken advocate for justice for Jamal Khashoggi's murder, any move by US government to call for the Crown Prince to be granted sovereign immunity in the case would represent a betrayal of Biden's promise to hold Saudi Arabia accountable. Abdullah Alouf, the research director of Dawn, a non-profit organization that promotes democracy in West Asia that was founded by Jamal Khashoggi and a co-plaintiff on the case against the Crown Prince, said it would be preposterous and unprecedented for the Biden administration to protect him. It would be the final nail in the coffin for attempts to hold Khashoggi's murderers accountable. District Court Judge John Bates said in an order released recently that he would hold a hearing on 31st of August after motions to dismiss the civil case by the Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman and others. The motions to dismiss the civil case rest on claims by Prince Mohammed's lawyers that the DC court lacks jurisdiction over the Saudi Crown Prince. District Court Judge John Bates said, in the court's view, some of the grounds for dismissal advanced by defendants might implicate the interests of the United States. Moreover, the court's resolution of defendants' motions might be aided by knowledge of the United States' views. The judge said he was specifically inviting the U.S. government to submit a statement of interest regarding the applicability of the so-called Act of State Doctrine, which states that the U.S. should refrain from examining another foreign government's actions within its courts of law. The interaction of that doctrine with the 1991 law that gives Americans and non-citizens the right to bring legal claims in the U.S. of torture and extrajudicial killings committed in foreign countries. The applicability of the head of state immunity in this case, and the U.S. view of whether Saudi Arabia's sovereign interests could be impaired if the case were to proceed. Agnes Callamard, the head of Amnesty International, who investigated Jamal Khashoggi's murder in her previous role as United Nations Special Rapporteur on extrajudicial killings, said it was laughable that the Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, whom she called an almost sovereign, could benefit from head of state immunity after the U.S. itself had concluded publicly that he most likely approved the operation to murder Khashoggi. Noting that Prince Mohammed bin Salman was not king, she added, Mohammed bin Salman, as the crown prince is known, is not the ruler of Saudi Arabia, and the United States should not recognize him as head of state. Doing so would grant him an authority and legitimacy he certainly does not deserve, and hopefully will never receive. Jamal Khashoggi's fiancée, Hatice Cengiz, could not immediately be reached for comment. The Saudi embassy in Washington was not available for comment either.
Wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
Racist policies are enshrined in Israeli law, however, one specifically denies 6 million Palestinians the right to return to the territory from which they were expelled only a few decades ago. The same law, however, permits Jews across the world to settle in any part of Palestine. Such practices, including the racial fragmentation of Palestine into zones of control, where half of the population enjoys full rights of citizenship denied to the non-Jewish half, have led most human rights groups and advocates to label Israel as an apartheid state. Meanwhile, Israel continuously and explicitly rejects international consensus and seems to have found strong support for their radical position from the Texas Republican Party in foreclosing any chance of a Palestinian state from ever being established.
Violence and instability are perhaps a good thing because violence implies that there will be resistance to this land grab and this denial of Palestinian rights. And as far as I'm concerned, the more resistance, the better. And Palestine needs to do resistance, and it needs its friends and allies to participate in resistance. I know that the policy of Iran and Syria and some other nations is to support Palestine in this kind of resistance. And in fact, it is now going in the direction that the entire world is saying, well, we're not going to listen to the United States anymore and NATO, for example, because the United States has now declared sanctions against so many countries that those countries are unifying amongst themselves to defy the United States. So we may be entering a new period when, unfortunately, violence, but resistance and most likely violent resistance is the only answer to the warmongers.
Though party platforms do not necessarily translate into government policy, critics cite the former U.S. President Donald Trump and the support enjoyed by Israel amongst powerful religious figures, as well as fringe elements in the U.S. society, to argue that the most extreme and rejectionist views about the apartheid have become normalized in U.S. politics. In further signs that support for Israel has morphed into an extremist position in the U.S., the Texas Republican Party has approved a platform that will make it illegal to create a Palestinian state in territories controlled by Israel. The platform, approved by 5,100 delegations in Houston, supports the prohibition of a Palestinian state within the so-called historical borders of Israel, as they claim it would jeopardize Israel's security. This platform, in essence, only lays the groundwork for further Israeli aggression and discrimination against Palestinians. Currently, as many as 12 million people reside in historic Palestine, but full rights are granted by the regime to Jews only, leaving the remaining 6 million non-Jews prone to various forms of racial discrimination depending on their place of residence. But does this type of platform represent the thinking of the U.S. as a whole when it comes to Palestinians, that they shouldn't have a right to their own land?
The United States has a long tradition of denying people their land rights and their homeland. We've done it to 500 nations in North America. So this is not at all surprising that they would say that the Palestinians should be denied their homeland. At the same time, the Zionists are immensely powerful and have powerful friends in the United States. So particularly in the power structure and the political structure.
All this poses some serious question about the future of Palestinians in light of the US and Israeli plots amid what seems to be international silence over the matter.
NATO leaders have held a meeting in the Spanish capital, Madrid, to discuss the expansion of the military alliance. NATO has formally invited Sweden and Finland to join the US-led military alliance. This is a historic expansion of the 30-member bloc. The military bloc, in a collective decision, approved the applications of Sweden and Finland a day after Turkey dropped its objections to the move. The decision will now be referred to the parliaments and legislators of the NATO member states for final ratification. The process is likely to move swiftly as the US-led military alliance seeks to build a bigger front against Russian President Vladimir Putin. Finland and Sweden applied to join NATO after Russia launched a special military operation in its neighbor Ukraine in February. NATO has officially declared Russia the most significant and direct threat to the security of its members. That marks a radical strategic shift spurred by the Russian military offensive against Ukraine.
It's the first time this new vision of Russia and its role in Europe is reflected in the strategic document of the Atlantic Alliance. Until recently, until this summit, NATO operated within the framework of the old strategy that was adopted back in 2010 at the Lisbon summit, and this strategy described Russia as a strategic partner of the NATO alliance. So we have a very decisive, a very radical shift in the approach.
And for the first time in its history, NATO has listed China as one of its strategic priorities, claiming that Beijing's ambitions challenge the Western bloc's interests, security, and values. NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg says China is not a threat, but the alliance needs to be clear-eyed about the challenges it represents.
This shift will definitely color many new initiatives and steps taken by NATO, including its defense posture, its deployment patterns, including its rhetoric. So it is a kind of very important formal step which nails down the new normal and which will have a significant impact of what NATO is likely to plan in years to come.
Mm-hmm. Both Russia and China have reacted angrily to the accusations and threats directed against them by the NATO. Beijing has slammed NATO's warning as completely futile. In their recent gathering, NATO leaders said Beijing's ambitions, policies, and close ties to Russia pose a challenge to the interests and security of the military alliance. China has accused the alliance of, quote, maliciously attacking and smearing the country. Its mission to the European Union said NATO claims that other countries pose challenges, but it is NATO that is creating problems around the world. The confrontational rhetoric comes as the U.S. is stepping up efforts to increase its military presence in Europe.
Apparently, the assumption is that with more Western weapons coming to Ukraine, with more military assistance reaching Kyiv, with more exhaustion on the Russian side, the course of the military conflict might shift in Ukraine's favor, and that with time, Ukraine's negotiating positions might get stronger.
U.S. President Joe Biden pledged more American troops, warplanes, and warships for Europe. The U.S. has pledged over $5 billion in U.S. aid, yet Ukraine is losing the war. It is now believed the U.S. and Western allies are deliberately protracting the war to station more weapons and troops across Europe and militarize the public discourse.
Since the start of the war in Ukraine back in February, the prices of commodities have risen up sharply. But the rising prices of grain raise concerns about possible famine in different parts of the world. Russia and Ukraine together export nearly a third of the world's wheat and barley, more than 70% of its sunflower oil, and are prominent suppliers of corn. Russia is also the top global fertilizer producer. Russia has been accused of disruption in the transport of grain harvest in Ukraine. UN projections show that up to 181 million people in 41 countries could face a food crisis or even an outright famine. UK's Foreign Secretary Liz Truss has accused Moscow of using grain as a weapon.
Food should never be used as a weapon of war, but that's what we're seeing in Ukraine, with Putin's forces blocking the ports and stopping grain being exported around the world.
However, a look at history and UK's global imperialism reveals that London has often resorted to blockades to further its colonial ambitions. Starvation was a conscious resource for Britain's colonial projects. The starvation approach was used against countries like Ireland, Iran, India, Malaysia, and Nigeria. Meanwhile, blockades and sanctions has been used against a whole host of countries like Yemen, Iraq, Syria, Venezuela, and Zimbabwe, to name a few, which all point to how the UK has used food as a weapon of war.
The UK throne symbolizes all forms of evil and genocide that we can imagine in human history. And England and the Crown in particular are the representatives of that. For centuries, they have extracted their wealth from oppressed peoples around the world, have shored up their pockets, have used financial schemes to colonize and oppress peoples around the world, to divide and conquer oppressed peoples in order to gain wealth.
The famine of 1845 to 1852 in Ireland was a man-made instrument of war and conquest. Over a million Irish people died of starvation. 1.5 million more left Ireland, many on coffin ships. Before the genocide, the population of Ireland stood at over 8 million. 150 years later, and the population has never reached that figure. Mass starvation was a regular feature of life in India under British rule. The last famine that was inflicted on India was in 1943, when over 4 million people died in Bengal. The British Army took millions of tons of rice from starving people. Even when other nations tried to send aid to the people of Bengal, Winston Churchill refused the offers. Britain's imperial project in India, its aim and methods was not to prevent famines, but to engineer them. During the so-called Malayan Emergency of 1948 to 1960, the British introduced a food denial program called Operation Starvation. Its aim was to starve out those who were resisting Britain's looting of the country. When Iran was occupied by British and Russian forces during World War I and II, countless Iranians died because they were denied food by the occupying imperial forces.
It has been involved with certain genocides and, of course, the first war in Iran and so forth to kill, thousands of lives lost of Iranians. If we look back in history, this has not been, it has not only happened once, it has happened many times.
Iran declared itself neutral in both wars, but millions of Iranians lost their lives due to widespread famine and disease. In the late 1960s, the British armed and supplied Nigeria with mercenaries during the Biafran War in the name of protecting corporate oil. When it looked like Nigeria got the upper hand, Britain increased the supply of arms and ammunition. Britain supported a blockade against them, which resulted in countless people starving to death. The UK's imperial history shows that the regime in London tends not to care about the plight of people facing famine and hunger. And London's comments about using grain as weapon are a ploy to conceal its dark history.
To try to provide a different narrative against what is produced by the mainstream media is not an easy job. That's what Press TV has been trying to do all along. The coverage of issues like the Israeli regime's daily atrocities in the occupied Palestine, U.S. war crimes in countries like Iraq and Afghanistan, and the U.S.-backed Saudi war in Yemen, and the very fact that the hypocrisy on the part of the so-called mainstream media has brought Press TV on the wrong side of many people.
I think Press TV had a huge amount of success, certainly in the early years. Of course, they've faced a lot of pushback. Of course, the Zio Western media controls satellites. It controls a lot of the media output. So in more recent years, of course, there's been a tacit campaign, a concerted campaign, to try and stop Press TV being able to get as far as it could. YouTube have been involved. Many of the sat channels, which are owned by Murdoch over here in the West, also turned on them. But nonetheless, there is a real substantial audience of Press TV which is picking up those rights and then sharing it across social media.
Press TV has faced hardships and bans since the very first days of its launch. Perhaps the most notable of such bans was in June 2021 when the channel's web domain was seized by the United States. In fact, by shutting down Press TV, the U.S. decided for 1.4 billion English-speaking people on the planet that they can no longer watch and listen to news that goes against the U.S. narrative. But why is it that a platform like Press TV faces so many restrictions? A recent poll by the Reuters Institute for the Study of Journalism paints a grim picture for the mainstream media. Not only are they losing their viewership, but their viewers also trust them less.
Trust in news is also declining and is lowest in the United States. On average, 42% of people said they trust most news most of the time.
Such news is not good news for the mainstream media, of course. People tend to turn to other sources of information that offer a different narrative, such as Press TV.
So the reality is that the Western media has played an absolutely diabolical role in terms of its kind of balanced reporting on West Asia as a whole. So not only Palestine, but Yemen, Syria, Iraq, Iran, that whole region. Western media has essentially been part of the terrorism that has been wrought on the entire region by Western imperialist military forces. The media in the West has really ridden shotgun and supplemented the psychological operations aspect of whatever they wanted to do in that region. What they want to do is obviously to subjugate the Yemenis, subjugate the Iraqis, subjugate everybody in that region to continue to maintain their hold on energy resources and various other geopolitical interests.
To get a glimpse of just how different Press TV is from other mainstream media, one can look at an open letter signed by more than 2,000 Canadian journalists last year about how biased their media is towards Israel.
Anyone who has worked in a Canadian newsroom has encountered the reluctance or resistance in covering Israel and the occupied Palestinian territories. Canadian style guides still ban the use of the word Palestine in their coverage.
After publishing the letter, some journalists even published another letter saying they fear retaliation over publicly discussing such matters. In a world where mainstream media even censors their own journalists for using the word Palestine, it is no wonder that a platform like Press TV has faced so many hurdles and bans.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
ایمان را در خودتون تقویت بکنید، ایمانی که هم در اینجا شما را شرافتمند می کند و هم در پیشگاه حق آبرو دارید و با آبرومندی وارد می شید به تخت اعلی.
In the path of the Imam.
In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. As a reminder, it was said that Imam Khomeini protested to the ratification of the scandalous bill known as capitulation in the Iranian parliament in 1963. The Imam, in his speech, castigated the parliament and the government, alarming the ulema and the nation against a great danger. Today, we are going to narrate the aftermath of Imam Khomeini's protest and his exile to Turkey. Stay tuned, please. One week after the release of Imam Khomeini's statement against the capitulation bill, the agents of regime arrested him. The Imam, in his statement, had called on the Iranian nation, the ulema, the army, the lawmakers, preachers, university students, and professors to break silence against this scandalous measure. He said, "The Iranian nation must break these chains. The Iranian army must not let such scandalous things happen in Iran and rather call for overthrowing of the government and expelling the lawmakers who have voted for this. The nation should ask their ulema not to keep silent in this issue. It is an obligation on the ulema of Islam to ask the sources of emulation not to ignore this issue. It is an obligation on scholars and teachers of seminaries to ask the great ulema to break silence. It is obligation on preachers to protest against this issue strongly and fearlessly and awaken the nation. It is an obligation on university professors to make the youth aware of what is behind the curtain. It is an obligation on university youth to oppose zealously against this scandalous plan and cause the voice of opposition to reach the world nations through sensitive slogans. It is an obligation on all the strata of the nation to forget their trivial and periodical conflicts and try in the way of the sacred goal of independence and exit from the shackles of captivity." Thank you. The regime of Shah arrested Imam Khomeini at night as it was scared of people's reaction. Thus, the commandos of the regime assaulted the imam's house and broke the door and climbed the walls of the house to arrest him. The imam's wife, Ms. Khadija Saghafi, narrates, "On the night that they arrested the imam, I was sleeping in a room with a wall next to the alley. I woke up from the sound and roar of the crowd. I came out of the room to the veranda. I faced a strange scene there. The commandos of the Shah were climbing over our wall one by one. Almost every 30 seconds, one man would climb over, although the wall was high and there was no ladder. The sound of their gasp had filled the place, showing their anxiety. Suddenly, there was a sound of kicking the door between the interior and the exterior, and it was broken." Lady Saghafi says that at this time, the imam was performing his midnight prayer. She continues, "The imam was awake from the beginning, performing his midnight prayer and seeing everything. Then he gathered some things which he would need after the arrest, like the clay for prayer, handkerchief and comb. At that night, the door was broken and the imam shouted, 'Keep quiet. Do not break the people's door. I will come myself. Why are you acting savagely?' He was speaking so impressively that there was silence everywhere and no one dared to move. Everyone was petrified. Everyone was standing where they were. No one was moving as if they were all electrified." In those critical moments of the Shah's commandos breaking into Imam Khomeini's house, not only the Imam didn't have the least fear, but he soothed his family, especially his wife. His wife says, "The Imam came to me slowly. I said, 'They arrest you as I said.' He said, 'Don't fear.' Then he took out the ring having his seal from his pocket and said, 'Keep this till you hear from me. Don't give it to anyone else. I put you under the care of God.' I bid him farewell and he went. They were taking the imam by a Volkswagen and my son Ahmad was running behind the car. Between Ahmad and the car, there were a few agents as the main directors of the operation. Ahmad had chased them while throwing some stones on them, but they did nothing. Ahmad came back and sat beside me. I was lying under my blanket. He said jokingly, 'The lady is asleep.' Although I could tolerate these things, I was very sad. I went under the blanket not to transfer my sadness to Ahmad." One of the personnel of Imam Khomeini's house had related to Ms. Saghafi that the imam had protested the agents of Shah for disturbing the neighbors. The lady says, "When the imam reached the end of the alley, he told them with strong words, 'Aren't you ashamed? Why are you being so savage? Why are you disturbing the people? Why are you breaking the people's door?' One of the commanders had told them to kiss the imam's hand as a sort of apology." The imam's wife continues, "This time too, they took the imam by a Volkswagen to Fatemi Hospital and put him in a Mercedes there. But this time, they didn't switch on the Volkswagen. They just pushed the car as they didn't want to make this much noise, although they made so much noise that they woke up all neighbors. Anyone who opened the door would face an agent who ordered him to close the door. This was the condition along the way up to the hospital. They took the imam directly to the hospital and from there to Turkey. Imam Khomeini's wife, Lady Khadija Saghafi, says that some of the agents of the regime felt sorry at their behavior with the Imam and wept. The Imam would calm them. Ms. Saghafi says, the Imam said that there were drivers in the cars and the man sitting by him would continuously contact Tehran, and there were two people on my sides. One of them was crying up to the airport and I was soothing him. He was sad as why he had chosen the job to behave such with a man like me. The Imam came across the Savak chief at the airport. He told the Imam, you will go to Turkey. The Imam told him calmly, so much better. The day after the Imam's arrest, his elder son, Mustafa, was arrested by the agents of Shah. Lady Saghafi narrates, the next morning, they detained my dear son, Mustafa, and released him after 57 days. They had proposed him in the prison that if he wanted, he could go to Turkey beside the Imam. Mustafa told me the issue, and I told him that they want to deceive us. It means that you have gone on exile on your own. Moreover, you are more effective in Iran. Try to release your father rather than being exiled. Furthermore, your going to Turkey will decrease people's zeal and everyone will say, thank God, the Imam is not alone. So he issued a message that he wouldn't go. Thus, they detained him again and this prevented him from being exiled. During the few days that Mustafa was in Qom, it was clear that he would not stay there as people would swarm and the commutations were different from the previous ones.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
A major benefit brought by Imam Khomeini was familiarizing people with concept of resistance. This is the part of the speech delivered on June 4th, 2022 by Imam Khomeini, the leader of the Islamic Revolution. On the 33rd demise anniversary of Imam Khomeini, greetings be upon him. Imam presented a new model for the Islamic Republic, which was completely different from those two systems. Liberal democracy, which is based on capital, and communism, which is based on dictatorship. In Imam's model, certain dualisms became coordinated and harmonious. The dualism that were previously attempted to be set against one another were brought together and harmonized. Imam put them next to one another. One of these dualisms was the execution of divine rules alongside observance of public expediency and interest. It was Imam who formed the Expediency Council. Some people think that it was I who established it. At that time, I was president. Imam wrote me a letter and held a meeting to establish the Expediency Council. Islamic rules were enforced, but the expediencies of the time and public interest were observed as well. This is what is meant by expediency. It does not mean showing certain consideration for individuals. Another dualism was attempting to the needy and insisting on economic justice, in particular economic justice, as well as generating wealth. Both the generation of wealth and justice in the case of poor must definitely be observed in Imam's viewpoints.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
Another dualism was the rejection of both oppression and accepting oppression. As a political system, government and nation, we will not oppress other governments and nations, and we will not accept the oppression either. We will not bully others, nor do we surrender to bullying. We will both strengthen science and economy and the defensive mechanism of the country. It was not the case that we only think of the economy and ignore the country's defensive mechanism and security. The opposite is true as well. Both national solidarity and unity and diversity and the existence of various political orientations must be officially accepted. This is another dualism. Officials should have both piety and purity and expertise and competence. How did he want to make this future distinct?
You've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellite. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 25 meters, 11,865 kilohertz every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iransat or Bat 5 and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Aminolemi, Kabul.
Shahanabad, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
Highlighting the United States' rights violations at the former U.S. Embassy in Tehran, which the Islamic Republic calls the Den of Espionage. Every year in late June and early July, Iranian activists get together to commemorate the American Human Rights Week to recount instances of U.S. rights abuses in Iran.
United States, who is, you know, shouting the human right, we think that this is just a, you know, slogan without any background. And because when it's go to the Iranian people, we think we have seen that these people have been targeted, and we do not receive any apology about that.
The week-long occasion marks a series of tragic incidents, all falling within the same time frame, killing hundreds of Iranians in the early years after the victory of the 1979 Islamic Revolution. Rights activists say in all of those instances, the footprints of the U.S. can be traced. One of the most tragic incidents was the 1988 shooting down of an Iranian airliner by the U.S. Navy, which killed all of the 290 people on board the doomed plane. More than three decades on, and Iran is still waiting for an apology from Washington. Rights activists believe the U.S. has not abandoned its double standards regarding human rights.
We know that more than 30 countries have received the negative sanctions from the United States. Sanction is something that violates the human rights, the right of the development, right of the education, right of the health.
The American Human Rights Week also marks the 1981 bombing of the headquarters of Iran's Islamic Republic Party, carried out by the formidable Mojahedin-e-Khalq terrorist organization, known as the MKO. 73 leading officials, including the then Justice Chief Ayatollah Mohammad Beheshti, were killed in the blast. The Islamic Republic says the MKO is responsible for killing 12,000 Iranians in different terror attacks. In 2012, the U.S. and Europe delisted the MKO as a terrorist entity, and since then, they have been taking part in the terror group's annual summits in Paris.
They have withdrawn the MKO from the blacklist, and this withdrawal paved the way for the Americans, not only for the Americans, but also for the MKO, to extend their own terrorist operations through the facilities that they are provided from the Americans and also from the European territories.
The 1987 chemical bombardment of Iran's city of Sardasht is another incident that falls on the same period in the Iranian calendar. Iraq's chemical weapons were reportedly produced using materials supplied by the U.S. and other Western countries.
Activists here say Washington has shrugged off its crimes in Iran, and that's why they observe the American Human Rights Week every year to take a jab at the U.S. for its selective approach toward human rights. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Alina Lip, a German journalist who has been reporting from the pro-Russian Donbass region of Ukraine for over 6 months. She recently received charges from the German legal system threatening her with 3 years in jail.
On 24th of February, I shared on my Telegram channel the news I said that Ukraine is killing civilians already